This is unbelievable. College basketball. Incredible.
You know they're going to try to run backdoor play if they can get it.
Under 10. Backdoor.
Goes out. Here's Davis. Davis for the win. He's got it. Princeton is going to the NCAA tournament.
This is part two of a conversation with Pete Carril. Really think that you're going to enjoy this because Coach has provided so many stories for those of us that have played for him, but also for many people that are interact with him on a day-to-day basis here at Princeton. And I felt like the best way to do this was to capture him in sort of two parts. So here we go. We're going to continue our conversation with Coach Carril.
When you arrived, did you have a sense of what this would all be? You came to Princeton. It's 1968, fall. You know, so this is a tough question, but 29 years later, you retire. You know, you're in the Hall of Fame.
Right.
You're in the NCAA College Hall of Fame. You're in the Naismith Basketball Hall of Fame. What did you foresee? What do you remember thinking that this could be a long?
I never thought that long. You know, if I had known what was going to happen to me, I'd be a little bit more fearful about taking the job. I mean, I never had trouble getting along with people. A lot of it was because I didn't care if I did or not. And
what do you mean? What would happen to you?
Well,
you
know, first of all, there's definitely a culture clash there with what I experienced at Reading and what I experienced here. In when you talk about bicker and all that kind of stuff, and guys were more interested in what club they belonged to, and everybody said that the team was close-knit, and it wasn't anywhere near what I had experienced at Reading and Lehigh for the only year I was there. So I had adjustments to make. We'd go recruiting, and we were recruiting against North Carolina and Duke and schools like that, and we got wiped out every time. And then we went down a notch. And then you'd see Syracuse. We got beat for a guy for Syracuse, and we lost a guy to Rutgers, you know. And so you'd see you had to go down another notch.
What do you think that what was the,
Some of it was that I was unknown. Some of it, I was not a famous guy. There are a lot of people in this town that thought I shouldn't have a job. And that was one of the things. And the second thing is it was getting more costly to go to school here. It was getting harder to get into school.
Do you remember the cost of tuition?
It was around $8,000, right? 8 to 11. I mean, my son went here, and I got a stipend of $750, which wasn't too much. But anyway, I wasn't overly confident, but I always felt that I could do something good. I always thought we could win, and I had terrific kids in it. What happened was that Brian Taylor come along, and then Teddy Monacus and Andy Rimmel and John Berger, guys like that. And then when I got Mickey Stoyer and Armand and Peter Malloy, they came there with experience from experience programs at one, and then Frank Zawinski and his class, Omachenko, mm-hmm. and Bobby Roman, those guys, they came in together, and we found a way to play where they could win, and they were good. They were successful. And a lot of that was cerebral, right? So we 1 year we were out rebounded 27 times the whole year. How could we? We're 23-4 that year. And so how can you do that unless you shot well and you didn't commit any turnovers?
One of the beautiful things about playing for you is that, you have an encyclopedic knowledge. It also works against you as a current player sometimes, but you talk about the those guys, those teams in the 70s. In particular, right. I think you're very close with a number of the guys you just mentioned.
Right.
But that 75 team seems to me that that was also you're close with that group, but you were younger.
Right.
And you maintain a real close friendship with a lot of those guys today. But it seems to me that that was, I think, maybe listening to you, that's when you felt like you really started to understand what you needed to do.
You're right. We lost to Arkansas in a heartbreaker where we should have won.
This would have been the 91 team?
Right. Yeah. We had lost to Georgetown before then, 89, and then Arkansas was better than Georgetown.
Mm-hmm. 99,
And one of the rules we made was we were going to have to play in back of them.
Behind the post. Right,
behind the post. Mm-hmm. You couldn't front them because our weak side help was too short. And you couldn't get there to disturb anybody. And the feeling was you have to make them shoot a shot to beat you. And it worked perfect till the last minute. We're up by one, a minute and 30 seconds ago or something like that. And we were working a high side. The guy goes in there, makes a layup, and he fouled him. And then they got the rebound on a missed foul. So we lost by four. But I didn't get angry about that game because what happened was I could see that they had given an account. They gave everything they had. And you can be happy. Hmm. And then, of course, the last year when you guys were at school, there was a lot of dissatisfaction that year on the team.
This was 1996.
Right. And how we ever won at Lehigh in the playoff game.
Yeah, we ended up beating Penn in a playoff game.
But we were playing them so badly. Gabe Lewells was terrific. Chris Doyle was terrific, played great. But we couldn't handle a pick and roll. That should have been a story that we could have worked on. I watched the way you coach and the help you get from your assistants. It's just good, really good. And you have these meetings where they tell you things that you have to consider. Well, we didn't do that enough. And I remember telling Stevie, don't have him take a three. You can't let him hide behind the screen. You got to go out there. And he didn't quite make it.
Steve doesn't like this story, but we still talk about Ira Bowman made a three at the top of the key to send the game in overtime.
And in overtime. Then
I remember you being very upset.
Oh, yeah.
And I understand that a lot better now.
I mean, at the time I told Stevie when I knew I was retired, I wrote it on the board there at Lehigh that I wasn't coming back. I was retiring. I told him that's the kind of mistake. You don't always pay for it. You make a mistake like that, sometimes you don't pay for it. But he did at the time. And what I told him at the time, I don't know if quite anybody understood it properly, that's the kind of mistake you don't want to ever make. And you have a chance now to not ever make that mistake again, right? So I don't know whether you did or not, but... That was a very important point for that kid to learn. But I liked him a lot. He's a good, really good kid. Mm-hmm. Your team was very easy to like, right? And then that was the end of it.
Well, you got all the way up to the end, but I want to talk about a couple specifics. But the matchup, when you played, you got a lot of steals.
Right.
And the matchup, and I like to tell people, there's a – there's a defensive philosophy out there, a way of playing, a system called the pack line defense, which is a very methodical, there's a imaginary line, if you will, that's 16 feet away from the basket, sort of goes, it arcs just like the three-point line. That's a line that the offense never gets into that line. And I always tell people, while I played for you, we were the best defensive team in the country. We're number one in scoring defense. And I don't know if we worked on – we didn't have – defensive drills every day, and it was what you taught us to see.
And
I think a lot of that stemmed from the matchup. Can you talk a little bit about the genesis of the matchup for you?
We started out with a 1-2-2 zone, which for 10 years was very effective because everybody tried to attack the zone the same way. They had a one guard front there, and any one guard front, I don't care what you do, you can get into a zone that'll stop it every time. It's when they have a two guard front, that's two guys on the outside, and you have to decide who's going to guard that guy, and what you're going to do with your point guard who's out at the point. And that we lost the game to New Mexico State in the finals of their tournament. We played very well, and that really exposed that, because that guy, somebody was hitting threes out of the corner, and we couldn't get them on time. And eventually that was the flaw of the defense, and then we changed it. So if they threw a cross-court pass, we call that two, and then you'd go into a 2-3 zone. That, and then what happened, it became what I call scrambled eggs. We lost sight of it. We had to go back to our man for man. And then we put in the zone for UCLA in 4 days. And, of course, we counted on the fact that they were a very strong team. They'd like to get the ball inside. So that zone at the time, I have a lot of compliments on that. That was rare that we stopped outside shooting. They couldn't understand how we stopped outside shooting and how we prevented the ball from going to the post. A lot of it was caused by the way they attacked the zone, but most of it was have an idea. You have to have an idea what they're trying to do to score against you. What are they trying to do? And then where are the passes coming from? And what passes can you defend, disturb, and one pass? What kind of pass you're wasting your time?
So this is what how you talk right. during practice. So right. this is if you don't mind. Like so, what when you used to stop practice a lot, and what do you see?
Right.
Was a right. favorite phrase. Like did you? And a lot of it sometimes was methodical. It was
right.
well thought out. I mean, I know that you were trying to get us to see, and I always felt like. You're preparing the team to win against the best teams.
Right. I always said that. Right. I think I always told you that. I'm preparing you to beat the team you're playing. I don't care who it was. And that could have been a suicide mission, but I never looked at it that way. And so that's a gift. I think that's a gift. And I look for that since you've been coaching here, for guys that have ability to see that, like Spencer, he sees in advance what's going on. Like Amir, they see that. That's important in your defense because it gives you an edge when you know what they're trying to do. Right, and then you have to keep your body in front of your man, which is one of the hardest things. To do in basketball. And then I think you have to use your hands. And we discussed that earlier today.
Mm-hmm. And you've convinced me.
Well, it took long enough.
Yeah.
I got picked up at graduate school as a professor. I told you what was the best guy ever. We're talking about Thomas Jefferson and the role of the colonists and the leaders in education. And his expression was the education of the discretion. How do you teach what you're supposed to do, what's wise to do? And so if a person doesn't have that, then he's not going to be ready to do what has to be done. You have to see that, all right? And so don't take away his chance of doing it. This is the main point. If you say, in basketball, they say, don't reach, don't do that. You know, all those rules they have. But you can't always do that. So if you can't always do that, then you tell them, well, we don't want to do that. And I'm saying that when they can't do it, see if you can teach it.
Right, you're touching on something that I think is really important about you is you believe in change.
Oh, yeah.
People
yeah.
changing.
And right, right.
You had a phrase sometimes 2 weeks into practice where you'd be trying somebody at forward that was
right.
a guard or
right, right.
somebody at center that was a forward, and you'd say, the grand experiment is over.
Right.
But it really wasn't. You were always trying to
right.
get somebody to believe that, can you do this?
Right. Well, I always felt, I mean, that lesson it had nothing to do with basketball, but it's a lesson to remember. If a person, it's like voting. The guy doesn't know how to vote. So if you don't know how to vote, you take a test, you don't know how to vote. You don't know what's going on. So don't let him vote. That's ridiculous. So a guy doesn't know how to vote, well, teach him how to vote. Don't tell him who to vote for, but show him give him some evidence of what to vote for. And I think that's true of everything. Show him how to do. If you can't do something, try to show him. And some can learn it and some cannot. But you don't want to give. I don't think you want to give up on that philosophy, because you're going to be more successful than not in showing guys, and especially using your hands. Your hands are 3 feet long, and there's another one. Don't reach, because you foul too much. And my thing was, go ahead and reach, but don't foul. Show them how to reach without fouling, or never foul a jump shooter. If you don't contest a jump shot, he's going to make it. Well, show him how to contest a jump shot to prevent him from fouling. You can do that. All that can be done. And we try to do that. And that's why for the longest time we were really good on defense. Because mm-hmm. The other teams were more physical than us, but I felt we used our brains a little bit more.
Oh, yeah.
And so that was a factor.
I felt like I never was a good shooter. When I got here, shooting, obviously there were a lot of really good shooters in the program, but you mentioned that you took a lot of shots in college, but this was all of your team shot the ball very well. What was it that, you generally taught us how to shoot a set shot, mm-hmm. but it was
a stab, right?
Well, what was it about shooting that I've watched you sort of grab somebody and, within a few days that shot is going in a lot.
Well, actually, when I was coaching you, I didn't do as well a good a job at that as I should.
That's not your fault.
Right. No, right. But I think you learn. I've been learning since. Watching you coach, I'm learning things watching you coach. My mind is not closed to learning. All right, and thank God I never thought I knew more than anybody else, right? And it seems like I consider that an asset, right? That I could think my way through things and see how I could do better. And I watch you. What you're spending more time on shooting than I did, and it's showing up. It's showing up during the course of the game. I was in the service with a guy that played at Kentucky. And he said that Adolph Roop spent 1 hour on spot shooting. That's a long time for one single thing. And, of course, we lost to them one time. They were making 25, 28-foot shots. And it worked. You could see what he was doing. And so as I go along now, And shooting has become more important now than ever because the pace of the game is faster. And then the clock. The clock is a factor of why we were so successful. I don't know that it's so hard to be successful anymore.
Mm. Right. So when you coached for a large part of your career, it was a 45-second clock.
And then right.
towards the end of your career, it went to a 35-second clock. Now, it's,
right.
of course, the clock's at 30.
30. Now it's hard. See, now, for example, for you, nobody still wants to play you, mainly because they're worried about losing, right? And they don't want to play a team that moves the ball around. Why should you play a team that knows what they're doing when you can play against a team that doesn't know what they're doing? You have a better chance. So that's why you're having a hard time. I know you. When you get on a phone call, like Villanova, they should play you. Villanova, LaSalle, those right around here, you should be able to play. We used to play St. John's. And then we had that win over, lost to Georgetown. I guess who it was, I don't forget who's in charge. And I'm not sure if it's true or not, that he just said, don't ever play anybody. Don't ever play anybody in the Ivy League you want, but don't play Princeton. And so that's true, except for Syracuse. They would play us, but it had to be there.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know how I got on that subject.
Well, but, yeah. Well, you talked about, you know, the being open-minded. I mean, we...
Right.
Sometimes I think you did it as a joke, but you would say, I'm right 86, 87% of the time.
That's,
right?
that's another lesson I got from paying attention.
Mm-hmm. And
they had a president here, Bob Goheen, and he was really a scholar. And I don't know that he understood what I was doing, you know, but I understood what he was doing. And he made a statement one time that his father was a missionary in India, and he said he learned that at that time they felt, whether it was the Indians or whether it was himself, that they didn't want to be more than 85% right. And because if you insist on being right, a lot of times you're going to have to lie to be 100%, and they're what I call true believers. And my motto is to stay away from them, because they're going to fail, and they take their friends down with them. So you got to admit when you make a mistake, but a lot of guys don't want to do that. See, and I don't know that I don't think I'm in that camp. If I was, I've since learned that I'm not in that camp. When I make a mistake, that's it. Mm-hmm. I just don't make too many of them. That's it.
Right. You know, you mentioned earlier, and you know, you and I have talked about this, and you know, playing for you was one thing, but coming back now as the coach and being in the relationship that you and I have, it's very different.
Right.
It's much nicer.
I mind my own business.
Well, no, but I would say, like, it's not. You know, if you asked every guy that ever played for you what were the things that made you such a good coach, there would be a lot of different answers. But they would all add up to sort of something similar, which is you're honest. Mm-hmm. You told people exactly what you thought. Most every guy, and I've talked to a couple of former players, the first thing they say is that on their recruiting visit, you told them what they weren't good at.
Mm-hmm.
And it seemed to attract, and this is one of the beauties of – one of the most amazing things to me about Princeton basketball seems to attract a pretty humble guy, somebody that's willing to listen to some criticism. Would you agree with that?
Yes, I do. I do.
Was that purposeful?
Yes. Yeah. I think what I did was try to help them. Like I'd say, whether you come here or not, what I'm going to tell you is good for whether you come here or whether you don't come here, right? Then I tell them what I think they had to do.
You told me, I'll remember it exactly, you don't shoot the ball very well. You don't dribble the ball that well with your left hand. You're not an expert dribbler. But if you'd like to come, we'd like to have you.
Right.
And no one had talked to me like that. I loved it.
Well, I know one
thing. And you were right.
Well, I know one thing. You can dribble the ball now. I'm watching you show the guys how to dribble. But, you know, even there with Chris Webber, when I was in the pros then, he had to decide whether he was coming back to Sacramento or was going to be a free agent. And so he came to the gym. In between then, he was going to work out. And so I told him, I said, let me work you out a little bit. And so we did. And he told guys that was the hardest workout he ever had. I remember his sneakers were wet. You could see he did work. And he first started by shooting a jump shot, and he was jiving. I went, no. And then he got the idea that I was going to watch him carefully. And he did. And so he decided to come back. And he told people that when he decided to come back that the workout I gave him, worked him out, did something. I don't know whether it did or not. And so that was the point that I made then at the time. If you decide to sign somewhere else, what I'm telling you, this is going to help you. If you decide to come here, come back here, it'll help you here. And so that was it. But, you know.
When you talked about the NBA. When you first arrived in the NBA in 1996-97, yeah. And then you were there, you know, 13 years assistant. And, in the beginning, you were with Rick Adelman.
No, in the beginning, I was with the guy from Boston. What did they call him? He said, no, it's San Francisco.
Oh, God. Gary St.
That's it.
Thanks. Gary St. Jean?
Thank goodness you're here, buddy.
No, I need to do my research a little better. So what did you find was the you know, I mean, I always think all of us always felt like you'd be very good in the NBA. Anywhere you went, you could be very good. But what was it? What was the difference, the immediate difference to you? And what were some of the challenges?
The most challenging thing that I had to do was to prove that I knew what I was doing. Because when you're as short as I am, a little guy, and came from an Ivy League school, what does that guy know? You know what I mean? And so I had to prove myself many times.
In the coaching rooms and on the floor, right?
Right.
With the other coaches.
I don't even want to mention names because the outcome was bad. But I told a guy about fronting, about picking up a guy, and the guy starts to drive around his man, and he's guarding a big guy underneath the basket. Don't leave right away. Fake it. Hunch a little bit. Stun a little bit. That's better. Stun a little better. Make him think you're going to pick him up so you can play the pass. He said, oh, I was always taught to step up. And he stepped up. He threw the ball at his man. He stuffed it. And we didn't make the playoffs. My first year there.
Part of the reason why I thought you were so good here is that you're, and you mentioned it earlier, you were saying there was a clash, but that's when, you know, you came down to the gym, it was time to go to work with you.
That's
and
right.
You were exact, you were honest, it was very hard because you were also going to school, but it was the attention to detail.
Yeah.
And your background was such that you demanded that we played in a certain fashion that was, you know, basically just tough.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I think that the NBA, you got a lot of guys that you're running up against that maybe from different conspiracies, but those guys are smart.
We had a good 8 years there that I enjoyed because we had Chris Webber, of course, was good. Vlade Divac was a great passer at center. And then you had Mike Bibby as a shooter and Peja Stojakovic, Bobby Jackson. And the other guard that I keep on forgetting his name too, darn it.
Doug Christie. Doug Christie. That was
and
a great
I remember
team.
Doug, we were playing against a team, and the guy had 34 points or 43 points, and he was going to guard him. And he was all conference defensive player. But the guy scored off him. I said, look, your problem is that you try to guard everybody. For us to win tomorrow night, this guy can't go 43 points. You've got to be in the low 20s or a little lower than that. And for a change, I think he paid attention because the guy had 13. And he stayed with him. And I told him about it. I said, look you're the guy that won this game. You have to understand that. But he went back his old ways the very next game. So I don't know how I got to that point, but
it's hard to get through to guys, right?
Yeah, I guess so. Right.
So I think some of your favorite players, you know, they stay with it.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Well, that was good. I mean, I enjoyed 8 or 9 years of my time there. Rick Adelman being the coach is a good guy.
When you decided to You know, you left the NBA. You know, you still watch it a lot. What do you see in the game? Like, what are the things that you're seeing?
It's a very interesting game now. If you went to coach in the NBA the way I'd like to see it, you'd be a failure. See, because there were so many faster players, so many better shooters, and the pace of the game is so much faster. I'm worried a little bit as it goes on into the future that there seems to be a gentle cooperation between entertainment and competition, which I don't like. It's got to be entertainment is not it. So you couldn't be entertained by the way we played. You know, we play Pendegiel boring. Well, there's some people after, as you talk to Penn guys, they respected us trying to beat him, but the fans didn't. And that worries me about, especially professional basketball, that too many games are the same. And you got to watch it, too, that the more, and the football especially got to watch it, because they play three times a week now. And as popular as that game can be, you get too much of it, you're going to see that it's going to lose something, right? And I see soccer is growing in this country nowadays, right? And the fans of Seattle are huge at fans. Even the Red Bulls here are big fans. So the game has changed. Of course, the demography of the country has changed too. But that's the one thing I'm worried about in the NBA. But the talent level is so good. Then they throw the ball away a lot. And so what I think in keeping is sort of what I feel. Don't tell them not to pass. Pass right. Mm-hmm. So in other words, as they play and play, they're going to get better. And the style of ball is going to get better. And they're not going to make so many bad passes. Provided they don't play so many games that they don't care. And that's going to be it. But it's crazy the way people are going for basketball these days.
Mm-hmm.
Which is good for me. I enjoy watching it.
Who do you like watching the most?
Well, I like watching San Antonio. And, of course, I like watching Golden State. And you have to enjoy watching Cleveland as they came along with him. Boston Celtics, I enjoy watching. The Knicks, you're gonna enjoy watching now. They got this guy, Noah. He's a terrific young. His father, a great tennis player. He's a heck of a passer and very good defender and rebounder. He's going to be fine, just what they need. And they have Jackson. They got a coach that was really a good player. So he knows how they have to play, and they'll respect him, I think. So I see them getting better. So it's going to be a lot of teams you can like now.
Mm-hmm.
See?
So we have Kerry Kittles on staff, and when he played in the NBA, towards the end of his career, he played on these Nets teams with Jason Kidd as the point guard, Kenyon Martin, and the assistant coach on that team was Eddie Jordan.
Right.
And they ran a lot of the Prince stuff. Kerry talks about sort of their versions of what they were doing, which is heavily influenced by you. But do you look at some things you see and see, and how do you feel when you see kind of your imprint on the game at the NBA level? And then I want to ask you about how do you feel about all the college coaches that have played for you. And
there's when you think right down to it, I mean, two guys are on the same team. How can they play together? You can throw the ball to the guy, or you can dribble the ball to him, right? And you can throw it to him and set a screen for him and go away. You know, playing without the ball is the way I call you. You can go towards the ball, go away from the ball, or clear the area, give a chance to play. So it's not going to be that hard, you know. The hard part is, do you want to do it? You want to shoot the ball a lot. They call them ball stoppers in the game today. A lot of those guys around. But the good teams, they move the ball around, and they all do better. So I don't know. Did I get the answer to the question?
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah, I mean, I think what you're describing, you know, I sort of can say Golden State, you know, San Antonio teams that we've all enjoyed watching. The ball's moving a lot more.
Well, just look at the changes it made in Princeton basketball since you've been here. You're running the heck a lot more than we did, right? You're shooting faster, right? But the game is still a team game.
Mm-hmm.
Just because you play the way you're playing, and there's very few guys that hold the ball on your teams here, I notice. They seem to know when it's their turn to go one-on-one. That's an art itself, which you get from the coach. But they move the ball. They shoot faster. They run more. So that's fine. I mean, I enjoy watching your team practice. I enjoy watching them play, too, right? And I enjoy watching a lot of teams, college teams, play. I'm worried about the Golden State team is that they make so many shots, so many games, that it's going to become boring seeing it.
Right.
It's like this, like, for example, a baseball team, they hit 20 home runs every game. After a while, the fans will be rooting for a 1-0 game.
Right. I mean, you've been preaching the value of making long shots well before the 3-point line, but you know, Steph Curry shot something like 50% from more than 26 feet away from the basket. Right. We've never seen anything like it.
Well, what happened to him is they roughed him up a little bit. He went down his percentage went. But he'll learn from that. I mean, but what I don't like is they just put another great player on their team. And so what happens is, you know, it's like a pickup game down at the playground, and the guy takes the five best players, and they win every game, and then the losers sit down, and they feel good about what they've done. Well, good. But there's so much money involved now.
Yeah. And more coming.
Right.
Coach, there's one of the nicest things you can say about anybody is how many people that have been with, spent time with, worked for somebody, and what are those people doing now? And there's so many of us that have benefited from, having played for you, having coached with you. You know, with you, it's, you know, the list is long. You know, you've got a lot of Division I college basketball coaches, Craig Robinson, Chris Mooney, Mike Brennan. Brian Earle, myself, Sidney Johnson, Bill Carmody was an assistant, Joe Scott played for you as assistant at Holy Cross, Dave Blatt having coached. And then you've got a lot of guys like Jeff Petrie that are in executive positions, Steve Mills with the Knicks. How does that make you feel?
Well, you know, when they mention it to me, I feel pretty good. But each one of them is, as I've noticed, is coaching within their own framework, with their own feelings and their own philosophy, which I like. They don't go around saying that it's a career system or none of that. I mean, Chris Mooney, I watched the way he plays, and he said, I don't know if we can play the way we played when I was at Princeton. Because in that league, it's a faster league, and and the clock changes everything, right? It's amazing that when you take a test, and they have a 30-minute time test, and the smartest guys finish first all the time. And the ones that have a hard time reading or don't have good command of the subject don't ever finish it. And half the papers are blank. It's the same thing. If you have to go by the clock, what amount of cerebral aspects of the game are disappearing or will disappear? And that's something that worries me, but, you know, as I said, I was 86 the other day. I didn't worry about that too much. But.
Well, you've got to feel...
Oh, I feel good. I feel good. But I feel good that they're doing it. I don't interfere. I go down to watch them, go down to help Mike once in a while, go down to help John. I'm just glad they're doing well, you know.
Well, I know you hate compliments, and this is.
But if you watch them play, they coach like they played.
Right.
So that's it.
You know? Well, so much of what we all do, I know for myself, is we You know, I say to my staff, talk the way we talk, and that's really the way you talk. Ask, what do you see? What are you thinking there? Mm-hmm. Didn't you see that?
Mm-hmm.
And it's, you know, think about, see what you see, and then do it. And I remember your advice to me was, you know, the day I got here was be yourself.
That's right.
I think when you mentioned earlier, you know, you make a lot of mistakes as a coach. That, you know, you're right. You make a lot, but you know, it's. You should know that there all of us govern ourselves sort of by the things that you said and say.
Well, I hope. I mean, I don't know for sure. Let's just say this: anything that I did for you that is good, I'm happy about. And anything that I said to you that was bad and you made it better, that's good.
Yeah.
So it's hard to be wrong.
When you put it like that.
Thank you.